Hello again. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's cover story, Do They Dare? The Democrats Will Likely Impeach, by Molly Ball. Plus, Why That's a Terrible Idea, by Donald French. The date of this issue is March 25th, 2019. We go right to the back of the magazine to make sure that we have time to include the interview feature. And the subject for this edition is Dr. Eric Topol. Time says Dr. Eric Topol, in his new book, Deep Learning, the cardiologist argues that artificial intelligence can bring humanity back to medicine. And the interview feature this week is called Eight Questions. First question. You tweet several times a day about the latest medical studies. Do you really read all of those articles? Answer. Every one of the 18,000 tweets come from me. People think I have an army of people to help me. No. I'm an information junkie. Ever since I was a kid, I've been an incessant reader. I apportion time every day, a couple of hours in the morning and the evening. Question. What is the biggest problem you see in medicine today? Answer. What's happened is an erosion of the relationship due to the lack of time doctors have with patients. We use keyboards and screens, and it's led to depersonalization of the doctor-patient relationship. Question. How do we reestablish that relationship? Answer. The answer came when I started a deep dive into artificial intelligence. It dawned on me that using technology to enhance humanity is the ultimate objective here. It's counterintuitive, but for doctors, what this means is the ability to have all of the data about a person assimilated and analyzed, to have scans and slides read. That liberates doctors from keyboards so they can look patients in the eye. Question. People can track their health now with their smartphones. Is that a good thing? Answer. Some of that data will be enlightening and really helpful, but some of it is going to be terrible noise and even lead to unnecessary testing and anxiety. It's a mixed bag, but we've seen citizen empowerment across all other sectors, and while healthcare is trailing, it's going to continue to get a lot of momentum. Question. What are the best examples of how AI can work in medicine? Answer. We're seeing rapid uptake of algorithms that make radiologists more accurate. The other group already deriving benefit is ophthalmologists. Diabetic retinopathy, which is a terribly underdiagnosed cause of blindness and a complication of diabetes, is now diagnosed by a machine with an algorithm that's approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And we're seeing it hit at the consumer level with a smartwatch app with deep learning algorithms to detect atrial fibrillation. Reader will correct that, with a deep learning algorithm to detect atrial fibrillation. Question. Is that really artificial intelligence in the sense that the machine has learned about medicine like doctors? Answer. Artificial intelligence is different from human intelligence. It's really about using machines with software and algorithms to ingest data and come up with the answer, whether that data is what someone says in speech or reading patterns and classifying or triaging things. Question. What worries you most about AI in medicine? Answer. I have lots of worries. First, there's the issue of privacy and security of the data, and I'm worried about whether the AI algorithms are always proved out with real patients. Finally, I'm worried about how AI might worsen some inequities. Algorithms are not biased, but the data we put into those algorithms, because they are chosen by humans, often are. But I don't think these are insoluble problems. Last question. Will we ever have an AI doctor to take care of all of our medical needs? Answer. The pinnacle of AI is being fully autonomous. But I don't think that will happen in medicine. AI will always need human backup. A machine could handle certain things autonomously, diagnosing a skin rash, for example. Doctors shouldn't be dealing with things that machines will do better than them. But serious conditions, like getting a cancer diagnosis, are what doctors should be working on. I think once patients understand that there are things they don't need doctors to do, they would love it once they get used to it. That was the interview feature, 8 questions conducted by Alice Park for Time with Dr. Eric Topol, his new book, Deep Learning. Eric is spelled E-R-I-C. Topol is spelled T-O-P-O-L. We go now to the front of the magazine. And there we are in the beginning of the brief section, and on the facing page is the recurring feature For the Record, a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a line or two-color drawing or a caption in bold or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page, a story illustrated by the monetary amount in bright red, $150 million. Caption explains, approximate amount paid by real estate investor A.B. Rosen's company RFR to purchase New York City's iconic Chrysler Building. $150 million. That item is also accompanied by a black and white drawing of the Chrysler Building with a red price tag on it. In the middle right margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Taylor Swift, singer-songwriter, in a piece for Elle about lessons she's learned before turning 30. And the quotation from Taylor Swift, quote, it's healthy for your self-esteem to need less internet praise, unquote. In the lower right corner of the page is the recurring feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, Honda. Automaker recalls 1.2 million cars over potentially faulty airbags. Under Good Week, Fonda. Actor Jane Fonda will be inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. Running along the lower left bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the number in bright red, 50. Caption explains, number of years it took a May 2, 1969 telegram congratulating a University of Michigan alum on his college's graduation, on his college graduation, to get to the recipient. 50 years. Caption goes on to say, a good Samaritan found it at the bottom of a filing cabinet bought secondhand. And your interviewer, flubbed the beginning of this item, just like he did this statement, and so we'll repeat it. 50, the number of years it took, a May 2nd, 1969 telegram congratulating a University of Michigan alum on his college graduation to get to the recipient. That item is also illustrated not only by the 50 in bright red, but a black and white and red picture of a telegram, presumably from 1969. In the middle left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Rotem Sila, Israeli TV host and model, in a March 9th Instagram story that promoted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to fire back on social media that, according to a 2018 law, Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people alone. The quotation from Rotem Sila, Israeli TV host, quote, "When the hell will someone in this government broadcast to the public that Israel is a country for all its citizens?" Unquote. And the caption did say that Benjamin Netanyahu, in firing back on social media, according to a 2018 law, Israel is the nation-state of the Jewish people alone. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Jeremy Corbyn, UK Labour Party leader, in the March 12th House of Commons debate of PM Theresa May's Brexit plan shortly before it was rejected. And the quotation in bright red from Jeremy Corbyn, UK Labour Party leader, quote, "It is simply not good enough to vote for a blindfold Brexit," unquote. In the top center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Andrew Lelling, U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, announcing on March 12th the largest college admissions racket ever alleged by the Justice Department. And the quotation from U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling, in bold black and all caps, quote, "There will not be a separate admission system for the wealthy, and there will not be a separate criminal justice system either," unquote. Caption goes on to say, among the dozens charged with scheming to get students into elite schools, into college, or college coaches, exam administrators, and wealthy parents. In the lower center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Billy Bai in a March 9th tweet about his dad, Siddharth Bai's shop in Missouri City, Texas. Quotation from Billy Bai, quote, "My dad is sad because no one is coming to his new donut shop," unquote. Caption goes on to say, after hundreds of thousands of retweets, the store sold out of donuts 2 days in a row. Billy Bai, and Bai is spelled B-Y. That was the entire content of the For the Record page. Now entering the major section called The Brief, that brings us to the subsection Opener and the subsection Aviation, where the headline is Boeing, the FAA, and Newly Nervous Flyers by Alex Fitzpatrick. March 10th dawned in Addis Ababa with excellent visibility and little wind, perfect flying weather that nonetheless became a backdrop for tragedy. That morning, Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 crashed minutes after takeoff, killing all 157 people aboard. Emergency responders discovered only burning wreckage and bodies. The victims' loved ones were left to grieve, and wait for answer. The world waits with them. The incident was the second fatal crash involving a Boeing 737 MAX 8 in just 5 months. Another MAX 8, flown by Indonesia's Lion Air, also crashed quickly after takeoff in October, killing everyone aboard. Experts have speculated that a new automated system meant to prevent, quote, aerodynamic stalls, unquote, which occur when a plane isn't producing enough lift and are addressed by pointing its nose down, may have sent the Lion airplane into a dive after detecting a stall where none existed. In the case of Ethiopian Flight 302, it will take months, maybe even years, to determine the cause of the crash. What we know about the Lion Air crash comes from only a preliminary report. But together, the incidents pressured airlines and their regulators worldwide to act, and shone a harsh spotlight on the Federal Aviation Administration, parenthetically FAA, the agency that oversees U.S. aviation safety. After the second crash, China, Australia, and Ethiopia were quick to ground the MAX, which has been Boeing's fastest-selling plane ever. Other places, including the EU, followed suit. In the U.S., however, the FAA insisted the plane was safe to fly, even as it announced a new requirement that airlines install an April software update for the MAX. But the pressure was intense. Passengers bombarded Southwest and American Airlines, which both fly the aircraft, with Twitter requests to change airplanes. And flight attendants' unions demanded that their employers ground the plane. Boeing lost $12.7 billion in market value on March 11th alone. Many American travelers assured on every flight that the FAA was concerned about nothing more than their safety, began to wonder. Then came the abrupt reversal. On March 13th, during a briefing on another subject, President Trump announced that, quote, all of those planes are grounded effective immediately, unquote. The airlines worked quickly to rearrange their fleets, and even Boeing appeared to scramble to get ahead of the news. In a subsequent announcement, the company said that while it still had, quote, full confidence in the safety of the 737 MAX, unquote, it was recommending that all of the planes worldwide be grounded temporarily as the company works to understand what went wrong. That's the question. Two unrelated crashes in 5 months is awful luck. Two crashes caused by the same issue is something far worse. In the interest of including more material down the line, we leave this article. There is more content. On the facing page, where the regular section called the Bulletin has the headline, Russians rally against plans for an, quote, online Iron Curtain, unquote. Article by Sierra Nugent. She writes, chanting, quote, hands off the internet, unquote, and, quote, no to isolation, unquote, thousands of Russians joined protests in Moscow and other cities on March 10th to denounce new legislation that would severely tighten state control of the internet. Lawmakers say isolating Russia from the global internet will protect the country's networks, but critics accuse the Kremlin of trying to create what some are calling an, quote, online Iron Curtain, unquote. And then Sierra Nugent goes on to list three items. First item, online overhaul. In recent years, Vladimir Putin's government has introduced a raft of measures curbing Russians' online freedoms, including blocking the messaging app Telegram in 2018. In February, a digital sovereignty bill took the first step toward becoming law. It's expected to pass, banning internet traffic from being routed through foreign servers and requiring it to pass through state-controlled infrastructure. Putin is also expected to sign off soon on two more laws to impose heavy fines on individuals and media outlets that publish, quote, fake news, unquote, or material deemed, quote, disrespectful, unquote, to authorities. Second item, dangerous game. Last year, in the wake of revelations that Russian hackers tried to influence the 2016 elections, U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton warned that Washington would respond, quote, offensively as well as defensively, unquote, to foreign cyber attacks. The sovereignty bill specifically cites the, quote, aggressive character, unquote, of U.S. policy and promises that by reducing Russia's reliance on U.S. web infrastructure, the state will be able to keep the internet running in the event of a cyber war. Local media say a trial disconnect from foreign servers will take place by April. Final item. Another great firewall. Protesters say the reforms will give Putin an unprecedented ability to suppress criticism. In a nation where offline forms of dissent, like street protest, are already tightly regulated. Many fear Russia's social media and search engines will soon resemble China's strictly censored internet. The internet has been a powerful tool for people around the world to challenge authoritarianism. But if other states follow Putin's lead, observers worry, that era could be ending. Entire article by Sierra Nugent. The right margin of this page is the sidebar feature, News Ticker, consisting of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Theresa May's Brexit deal rejected. The bargain that Britain Prime Minister Theresa May struck with the EU to ensure an, quote, orderly Brexit, unquote, was voted down for a second time by lawmakers on March 12th by a margin of 149 votes, leaving the UK on course to crash out of the bloc without a deal on March 29th, unless UK lawmakers and EU officials agree to delay Britain's exit. Middle item. Study finds race disparity in air pollution. Air pollution in the U.S. is disproportionately caused by white people, while black and Hispanic people are more likely to suffer its consequences, according to a study published March 11th in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. That is one formal title. Final item. Yemen strikes kill a dozen children. The UN said March 11th that 22 civilians, including 12 children, were killed in a 48-hour period by airstrikes in Yemen. As many as 30 more civilians were injured, including 14 children. The UN did not say who was responsible, and the warring Houthi rebels and Saudi-led coalition forces blamed each other. That was News Ticker. Moving forward in the brief, we come now to the milestones page. Lead item, under died, Carol Lee Schneeman, artist's artist. Observance by Laurie Simmons. Time notes, Simmons is an artist and filmmaker. Laurie Simmons writes, Although Carol Lee Schneeman claimed she would live and die as a painter, her work broke nearly every rule of that tradition. Carol Lee established a catalog of thought on gender, sex, and the politics of representation from which I and almost every woman artist I admire has taken a page. Way before the ideas of sex-positive feminism emerged in the 80s, her body-positive, pro-sensual art put her at odds with both 60s feminists, who saw her as exploitative, and male artists and critics, who saw her work as a tease. Like young artists today, Carol Lee, who died on March 6th at 79, moved freely between mediums, going beyond painting to film, performance, photography, installation, collage, sculpture, drawing, and writing. She reimagined the ways the human body could become art, whether using it as a non-sexual prop or artfully filming seductive kisses with her beloved cats. She was the consummate artist's artist, and although she did not achieve mainstream recognition until the last years of her life, she was, to us, a goddess who existed outside the rules of art world engagement. Understanding the full impact of her work on contemporary art, thought, and history will take years. Observance by Laurie Simmons on Carol Lee Schneeman. That item does include a photograph. It's a black and white, almost full color. And the caption says, Schneeman poses for a portrait at her home on August 23rd, 2017. She's holding arts materials, and there are many more arts materials in the background of the picture. In the right margin of the page, under Freed, Siti Asya, Surprise Release, observance by Charlie Campbell. And before we begin, the name of the subject is spelled first name Siti, S-I-T-I, Asya, spelled A-I-S-Y-A-H. Charlie Campbell writes, the evidence seemed compelling. Security footage showed two women approaching Kim Jong-nam, estranged half-brother of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, in Kuala Lumpur Airport on February 13, 2017, and put their hands to his face. That simple move killed the 45-year-old, an international playboy who had fallen out with his younger brother's regime. He died en route to a hospital from exposure to VX nerve agent. The women, both migrant workers, claimed they thought they were taking part in a harmless TV prank, parenthetically, four North Korean men who immediately fled Malaysia were also charged and are still at large. On March 11th, Indonesian national Siti Asya, 27, was freed after Malaysia dropped her murder charge without explanation. Quote, I did not expect that today I would be released, unquote, she said. Malaysia's Attorney General acknowledged relations between Kuala Lumpur and Jakarta would factor into any decision on the case. Asya's alleged accomplice, Dawan T. Wong, 30, is from Vietnam. With Asya free, Dawan was left facing the possibility of a death sentence while her lawyer appealed for her to receive a similar reprieve. Under Died, Kelly Catlin, a three-time world champion and Olympic silver medalist in women's pursuit cycling, on March 8th, at age 23. Under Sued, U.S. Soccer, by 28 members of the National Women's Soccer Team. The March 8th filing alleged gender discrimination in how they are paid and treated compared with male players. Under Arrested, two former police officers on March 12th for the murder of Brazilian politician Marielle France last year. The Rio City councilwoman had been outspoken on police brutality. Under Resigned, Juan Sanchez, CEO of Southwest Key Programs, a nonprofit that runs shelters that house migrant children for the U.S. government, on March 11th amid scrutiny of the group's finances. Under Sentenced, a Ugandan woman in London to prison on March 8th for the genital mutilation of her daughter. She is the first person in the U.K. to be convicted of the crime. Under Denied, a new trial for Adnan Syed, the subject of the Serial podcast by Maryland's Court of Appeals on March 8th. That was the entire content of the Milestones page. And on the Facing page, we have another edition of the feature within a feature news ticker. Again, three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Manafort sentenced to 7.5 years. Former Trump campaign head Paul Manafort was ordered to spend a total of 90 months in prison after federal courts gave him two partially overlapping sentences for a variety of crimes. Less than an hour after the second was handed down on March 13th, Manhattan's DA unsealed fresh charges against him. Middle item, Southeast Asia meth output booming. The amount of methamphetamine produced in Southeast Asia soared in 2018 per a March 11th UN report. Prices of the drug have dropped and usage has gone up, with 116 tons seized in 2018, compared with less than 40 tons in 2013. As organized crime has become more involved in the trade. Final item, California halts death penalty. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed an order on March 13th putting a moratorium on the death penalty in his state, thus granting a reprieve to the 737 people on death row there. Court challenges had stalled executions in California since 2006. But the move is expected to stir national debate. And moving forward, and that brings us to the next section, The View. The leading subsection is Weather, where the headline is Forecasting Catastrophe by Thomas E. Weber. He writes, the tornado that devastated Lee County, Alabama, on March 3rd, came as a shock, but not a surprise. Meteorologists had warned of severe weather days in advance. Forecasters monitored the area closely, blasting out warnings as soon as individual tornadoes were detected. Despite those efforts, 23 people died. How can we be so good at predicting dangerous weather and still lose so many lives in a single day? The answer lies in understanding not only the storms, but also the people and the impact of income, class, ethnicity, culture, and most of all, inequality on how we react to hazards. While solving the factors that put specific groups at greater risk would be a monumental task, there's a more realistic fix smarter warnings. Alerts that not only describe the weather, but also take into account human demographics and psychology, could save lives. Yet work on this front, surprisingly, remains in very early stages. The tragedy of Lee County illustrates one issue. Mobile homes, which accounted for multiple fatalities as the 170-mile-per-hour winds annihilated the structures. In 2015, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Severe Storms Laboratory, parenthetically NSSL, launched a pioneering project called Vortex Southeast to examine why tornadoes are disproportionately deadly in the southeastern U.S. Researchers there have discovered that lower-income individuals living in mobile homes are not only at greater risk for storm dangers, but also can be less prepared to respond to warnings. There is more to this article, but again, we move on to make sure that we can get as much material in this reading as possible. That includes the sidebar feature on this page, Short Reads. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. And this consists of three excerpts stacked one on top of the other. Top excerpt. Ending an atrocity. Every day in Yemen, 8 children are killed or injured in an ongoing humanitarian crisis. Nobel Peace Laureate Tawakkol Kaman argues that a rule should be applied to the outside forces waging war there. Quote, more money should not be spent on bombs than on life-saving aid. Unquote. Middle item, the nuclear option. Hans Blix, former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, calls for redevoting ourselves to using nuclear power and rethinking our view of radioactive waste. He writes, quote, one might even say that nuclear waste is one of the greatest assets of nuclear power, as it is so small in volume that it can be, and is, safely taken care of in its entirety. Unquote. Final item. Believing the next crisis. President Trump's declaration of a national emergency may cause unintended harm, say public health law experts James G. Hodge, Jr. and Lawrence O. Gostin by, quote, increasing public skepticism of critical health responses, unquote, constraining future presidents' abilities to act in more dire times. On the opposite page, the recurring feature is the risk report, and the headline is, ignore the polls, Trump has a shrewd strategy to win back the White House in 2020, by Ian Bremmer. Many foreign leaders, both U.S. allies and rivals, likely expect to be dealing with a new U.S. president after next year's election. Donald Trump's domestic troubles are mounting, and his poll numbers have been consistently low by historical standards. His favorability rating has never topped 50% in any poll published by Gallup. But regular political math doesn't apply to this president. In fact, at this early stage, Trump's odds of re-election are close to a coin flip. Low poll numbers didn't keep him from winning the presidency in 2016. He defeated Hillary Clinton with just 46.1% of the popular vote and a mere 26.8% of all eligible voters. He could repeat the same feat. According to Republican Party pollster Frank Luntz, Trump, quote, has a greater degree of support within his party than any Republican president has ever had since they started polling, unquote. If enough Democrats aren't happy with the party's nominee, overwhelming GOP support might be enough for Trump to win. Another reason so many are underestimating Trump's chances has to do with a shrewd bit of campaign strategy. Quote, nationalist populism, unquote, a phenomenon that's lifted many a lesser-known politician to prominence on both sides of the Atlantic, takes a slightly different form in the U.S. from that of Europe. In countries like France, Italy, and Germany, it's national identity that tends to separate, quote, us versus them, unquote. Race and ethnicity play a big role in U.S. politics as well, of course, but there's also a large ideological element that determines who gets defined as alien. In 2016, Trump cast undocumented immigrants as the key threat to national security and harmony. Next year, he will do the same to Democrats themselves. He has calculated that by labeling the Democratic Party and their presidential nominee as, quote, socialist, unquote, he can boost his chances of lifting Republican turnout and drawing centrist voters toward the GOP. He might be right. Voters aren't turned off by the progressive ideas the Democrats seem poised to campaign on. Recent polls find that around 70% of Americans support higher taxes on the ultra-wealthy, and 92% want Medicare to negotiate for lower drug prices. A recent Gallup poll found that 68% of Americans say money and wealth, quote, should be more evenly distributed, unquote, in the U.S. Yet, the word socialist turns off huge numbers of voters. Only 25% say they would back one for president. Trump knows his audience. As the world watches him his bombastic performances to tally up the mistruths and ugly rhetorical flourishes, Trump's eyes are squarely on the crowd at his rallies and the ecstatic receptions he receives. He has tested this line of attack against Democrats and has good reason to believe it can work. Bernie Sanders, one of the early Democrat presidential front numberrunners, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a fast-rising political star newly elected to Congress, have each embraced the label, quote, Democratic Socialist. In that quote, Democratic is uncapitalized. To amplify this message, Trump will again demonstrate his proficiency at social media, weaponry well-suited to blunt force messaging dominated by ideological labels rather than incisive explanation of policy detail. Other surprise winners in recent international elections have learned from Trump's mastery of these tools. In Brazil, for example, Jair Bolsonaro's victory was powered by a, quote, Brazil First, unquote, campaign on Facebook. The polls may still be against another Trump win, but a resilient U.S. economy, a clever political message, and ongoing changes to the ways Americans get their news suggest a fight to the finish. That was the entire article by Ian Bremmer. In the margin of this page is a sidebar feature, Quick Talk. And this edition is the subject, Tim Berners-Lee. Time says, as the World Wide Web turns 30, its inventor discusses how to fix its problems. Article by Billy Perigo. And this consists of a mini-interview. First question, when you first envisioned the web, did you predict any problems? Answer, first answer from Tim Berners-Lee, quote, from early on, we knew a powerful technology would be used for good and bad. But 2016 was a turning point. We had to make sure the web was serving humanity. Question, are you worried that data can be used to influence our behavior? Answer, I've got a vision for an alternative world where data is at the beck and call of users. A world where you have complete control over who gets access to it. Where programs work for you, not for Amazon or Apple. Question: can we trust tech giants if profit incentives don't align with what's best for society? Last answer: there's a backlash coming. Maybe people will decide that they want to live in an ad-free world and will do that by paying for it. There is also pressure on companies from consumers. And there's always the threat, in Europe especially, of regulation. Entire interview by Billy Perigo conducted with Tim Berners-Lee, inventor of the World Wide Web. And going ahead, we're now at the section called, we're still in the section called View, and the subsection here is called Scandal, where the headline is The Larger Lie of Elite Higher Education by Brian Kaplan. Kaplan is spelled C-A-P-L-A-N. And Time notes, Kaplan is a professor of economics at George Mason University and author of The Case Against Education. The FBI charged a list of well-heeled parents, including actors Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, with fraud on March 12th. Their alleged goal? To get their kids into top schools, including Yale and Stanford. The public reactions ranged from outrage to cynicism. The outrage? These parents think they could buy their kids anything. The cynicism? These parents could have done the same thing legally by charitably funding a new building or two. All this aside, the admissions scandal is an opportunity to separate the lofty mythology of college from the sordid reality. Despite the grand aspirations that students avow on their admission essays, their overriding goal is not enlightenment, but status. Consider why these parents would even desire to fake their kids' SAT scores. We can imagine them thinking, I desperately want my child to master mathematics, writing, and history, and no one teaches math, writing, and history like Yale does. But we all know this is fanciful. People don't cheat because they want to learn more. They cheat to get a diploma from Yale or Stanford, modernity's preferred passport to great careers and high society. What, then, is the point of sneaking into an elite school if you lack the ability to master the material? If the cheaters planned to major in one of the rare subjects with clear standards and well-defined career paths like computer science, electrical engineering, or chemistry, this would be a show-stopping question. Most majors, however, ask little of their students and get less. Standards were higher in the 1960s, when typical college students toiled about 40 hours a week. Today, however, students work only two-thirds as hard. Full-time college has become a part-time job. If computer science students slacked off like this, employers would soon notice. Most of their peers, however, have little reason to dread a day of reckoning, because, to be blunt, most of what college students study is irrelevant in the real world. Think of all the math, history, science, poetry, and foreign language you had to study in school, if you can. Indeed, you've probably long since forgotten most of what you learned about these subjects. Few of us use it, so almost all of us lose it. The average high school student studies a foreign language for a full 2 years, but according to my own research, less than 1% of American adults even claim they gained fluency in a classroom. Why do employers put up with such a dysfunctional educational system? Part of the answer is that government and donors lavish funding on the status quo with direct subsidies, student loans, and alumni donations. As a result, any unsubsidized alternative, starved of resources, must be twice as good to do half as well. The deeper answer, though, is that American higher education tolerably performs one useful service for American business: certification. Most students at places like Yale and Stanford aren't learning much, but they're still awesome to behold if you're looking to fill a position. Ivy Leaguers are more than just smart. When tangible rewards are on the line, they're hardworking conformists. They hunger for conventional success. From employers' point of view, it doesn't matter if college fosters these traits or merely flags them. As long as elite students usually make excellent employees, the mechanism doesn't matter. So why cheat your kid into the Ivy League or a similarly elite school? For the lifelong benefits of corrupt certification. When I was in high school, my crusty health teacher loved to single out a random teen and scoff, quote, "You're wanted for impersonating a student," unquote. If you can get your less-than-brilliant, less-than-driven child admitted, you'll probably get to impersonate a standardly awesome Ivy League graduate for the rest of his life. Of course, the super-rich parents the FBI is accusing could have just let their kids skip college and live off their trust funds. But it's not merely a matter of money. It's also about youthful self-esteem and parental bragging rights. As a college professor, I've spent years blowing the whistle on the wasteful system that employs me. When the FBI went public with this case, many of my Twitter friends declared victory on my behalf. Yet, truth be told, this salacious scandal proves next to nothing. It just illustrates the obvious. Though we casually talk about our, quote, institutions of higher learning, unquote, little learning is going on. Sure, college is an intellectual banquet for the rare students with a passion for ideas and the energy to locate the also rare professors with a passion for teaching. The vast majority, however, come in search of a stamp on their foreheads that says Grade A, and leave with little else. If the parents accused by the FBI are guilty as charged, don't say they fail to understand the purpose of a college education. Say they understood its purpose all too well. Entire article by Brian Kaplan. And moving ahead, and we now come to an article deep within the magazine, The Path to Impeachment, by Molly Ball. She says, top Democrats don't want to say it, but the House will likely move to oust President Trump. There is one person in America with the power to make Donald Trump's impeachment happen, and she keeps insisting she's not interested. Quote, I'm not for impeachment, unquote, Speaker Nancy Pelosi said in an interview published March 11th. Quote, unless there was something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, unquote, she told the Washington Post, quote, I don't think we should go down that path, unquote. Pelosi has been giving a version of this answer for more than a year now, but there's a reason she keeps getting the question. Whether Democrats will move to impeach Trump is the biggest political issue of 2019, and despite what Pelosi says, it's likely to happen. Democrats control the House, and about three-quarters of their voters favor impeachment. A well-funded grassroots movement is mounting an aggressive campaign to pressure wavering lawmakers. Multiple investigations into the president, his business, and his administration are underway. The one led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller may conclude any day. But no matter what Mueller finds, many Democrats in Congress believe there's already ample evidence that Trump has committed crimes and proven himself unfit to serve. These lawmakers see moral imperative to seek the remedy prescribed by the Constitution. More than a quarter of the 235 Democrats in the House have already expressed support for Trump's impeachment. Virtually everyone else is taking a, quote, wait for Mueller, unquote, approach. But no one is ruling it out. And to many, the prospect of opening impeachment proceedings against Trump seems inevitable. Quote, it's not a matter of whether, it's a matter of when, unquote, as Representative John Yarmuth of Kentucky told CNN on March 12th. Conventional wisdom, Ed Washington, tends to treat impeachment as a fringe crusade, on a par with campaigns by anti-fluoridation activists or UFO enthusiasts, and views Pelosi as right to resist this momentum. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've gained much from it, and please be sure to listen next time. This is Randall Rickman, your loyal reader, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. And again, that's 919-832-5138. And it is my pleasure serving you, and we hope again that you will make time for time.